From the Sky News Centre at 5, Euro 2012 is now underway, but tournament organisers can't have their whole focus on the opener between Poland and Greece. UEFA's confirmed that Holland players were subjected to racist chanting during an open training session in Krakow. Former England star Phil Thompson says more must be done to crack down on such behaviour.
These things are still happening. And what happens? What do UEFA do? They turn a blind eye to it. They give them €3,000 fine, €5,000 fine. That is where the problem lies within UEFA.
13 more people are now either confirmed or suspected to have Legionnaires' disease. The number of cases from the Edinburgh outbreak has gone up to 74 today. Scotland's Health Secretary Nicola Sturgeon says they were anticipating the rise.
People have been arrested, are connected to disease. We need to make sure...
Apologies, that's not Nicola Sturgeon. The UN peace envoy Kofi Annan is calling for more pressure on Syria during talks with America's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Earlier, United Nations monitors reached the village of Al-Kabir, where dozens of people are said to have been massacred. Princes William and Harry are visiting their grandfather in hospital this afternoon. The visit comes amid suggestions the Duke of Edinburgh might not be out in time for his birthday. He turns 91 on Sunday, but was admitted on Monday with a bladder infection. Barry Gibb has paid tribute to his brother Robin at his funeral. The Bee Gees star has been laid to rest in his hometown. He died last month, aged 62, after a long battle with cancer. That's the latest. I'm Jenny Lyne.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Britain has gone further down the surveillance road than any state in the world. No money for schools, but plenty for the snooping technology. Big Brother's lurking at the end of a city-wide CCTV feed, and shoppers are being tracked round Cabot Circus. But when someone is attacked or robbed in front of a camera, well, we're sorry, there isn't any film, is often the reply from the authorities. We're joined by a surveillance expert who helped force Birmingham City Council and the police to remove CCTV, which had been set up all round a predominantly Muslim residential area. That's Steve Jolly. And we look at the future of Bristol's transport. Rapid transit is on the cards, but where will it run? And we've been here before, so will it really ever happen? Plus, a review of last weekend's Bilderberg's Secret Rulers of the Western World. We explain what the BBC didn't tell you that it was even going on, because their man was inside and sworn to secrecy. That's part of Martin Summers' usual roundup of world events in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 10 degrees Celsius tonight, some light rain and gusty winds. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday, cloudier on Sunday with some light rain. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, a fairly cloudy week with plenty of showers. Next weekend, 16th and 17th of June, that's highs of 16 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some sunshine and some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend showery weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. First this week, though, the Lopresti report, and a Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, said on this show that he would give me a copy of the 2012 Bristol Provincial Yearbook for the Freemasons. That was on Friday the 13th of March 2012. This lists the membership of Bristol's 2,000 or so Freemasons in roughly 50 lodges. Jack also said he would arrange a guided tour of the Masonic Hall at 31 Park Street, as the Freemasons have nothing to hide. Well, 4 weeks, actually 6 weeks now on, two letters, no replies, and no provincial yearbook from Jack. But he has informed me that there is an open day at the Bristol Masonic Temples behind the Council House on Saturday the 16th of June. So, joining us for this week's news review is Conservative councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Hi, Chris, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there.
First of all, Chris, what's your position on the mayor? First of all, do you think it was a good idea for the city to vote to have an elected mayor?
Well, can I say that if we get a person elected who is going to do a very good job for the city, then I think it's probably a good move. However, my personal opinion, and I say that it is a personal opinion, is that it would have been better to have had a mayor for the greater Bristol area. That way one can ensure a greater integration of those important services for the city and for the surrounding area. Something perhaps like, and dare I mention the word, the old County of Avon. Because the problem we've got currently is that some of the other areas don't like Bristol telling them what to do, and they may feel that an elected mayor in Bristol would be trying to do that. So I'd rather see a much wider scope.
So are you saying that relationships between the city and the authorities in Bath and in South Gloucestershire and in Somerset aren't what they should be?
I wouldn't put it like that. I would say that there is sometimes bad communication between local authorities locally.
Okay, overall though, are you in favour of this idea? Do you think it's going to make a big difference, positive difference?
Ask me next year.
Why do you say that?
Well, we'll know then, won't we?
Well, who it is. So if
and what they're doing.
And okay, so, yeah. But at the moment, you know, you're a Conservative councillor in the city. Are you proud to be a member of a party that's seen by many to be a bit Victorian, sort of rolling back the welfare state, you know, possibly, you know, people having to move across the country, you know, parts of our cities becoming gentrified and people aren't allowed to stay there anymore because of things like the benefit cap?
Well, let me say, as far as I'm concerned, the Conservative Party is a very Catholic party, with a Catholic with a small c, and there are lots of different opinions in the party, and that's how it should be. Any major party should have a lot of different opinions, and that's exactly the situation we've got as far as the Conservative Party is concerned. I'm not going to say that I'm in favour of everything that's decided at Westminster. On the other hand, I'm not going to say that there aren't some very good ideas coming out of Westminster.
But can't you get your house in order? Because for a lot of people, they're seeing the Conservative leadership at the moment, I'm not saying you particularly, but your leadership of your party, as a sort of avaricious bunch who are plundering, you know, for their mates, a lot of the public services under the cover of these sort of PR advisors who are telling them how to do it.
Well, I think it's an established fact that it's very, very easy to be in opposition. It's not so easy to be actually in power. But when you're in opposition, you can promise, you can threaten all sorts of different things, almost with impunity. Once you're actually in the driving seat, you've got to produce the results. And it's not always possible to produce the results that you want to produce, and therefore the opposition, whoever they are, can have a real good go at you. That doesn't matter what party's in power, whether it's the Conservatives, whether it's the Labour Party. I think we'll stick at that.
So you're saying that none of the parties are actually going to do what they said they were going to do before the election, because we've had now this rollout of the privatisation of the National Health Service, you know, parts of it now being up for grabs by private businesses, whereas nothing was spoken about this before the election, and this is exactly what all these mostly US private healthcare companies have been lobbying for years. So it seems like the Conservative leadership and the government is actually working in the interests of private US health companies, not in the people that put them into office.
Yeah, it's a very difficult question, that. there's good and bad on both sides. I wouldn't say that I would be in favour of all the services becoming privatised, because I don't think that's a good thing. However, having said that, and having been involved in health for quite a long time, there are advantages in using the private sector. It's got to be done with care, and if it's not done with care, then it's fraught with potential dangers. A case of be careful what you wish for.
Now, you know, you say that you were involved in health. What role have you played in health over the last decade or so then?
I was involved with the supporting patients as far as the Public and Patient Involvement Forum was concerned. I chaired that for a number of years, and when that was changed by the last government and they brought in the link to replace it, I chaired that for the first few years, helped to set it up, helped to set up the governance, etc., etc., and that was supposed to be all about looking after patients' interests. Unfortunately, like a lot of these things, they get waylaid and they start to go into other areas. Small pressure groups start to put pressure on these organisations, and it's very easy for them to lose their way. I didn't stand again for the chairman's chairmanship of the Link in Bristol because I had been elected to council and I felt there could be a conflict of interest. But I still had the interest, of course.
Now, before that, we used to have community health councils as well. I mean, you know, these were the... It seems that there's a bit of a problem here in that year after year, it seems successive governments keep changing the way that our health service is regulated, really, where patients, where they feel that they've been badly treated or members of their family have, that they can come in and they can almost ask for a sort of professional second opinion from the health managers rather than just from the doctors.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's been quite bad the way these organisations have been changed every few years. One of the problems you get with that is that initially you get some very good people. You get perhaps retired consultants, you get retired nurses, you get people who've had a lot to do with the health service, maybe as a patient or maybe as a volunteer. They've got good experience. They're very, very vocal, if you like. And when things keep changing all the time, they lose heart and they leave it. I know probably at least a dozen people in this city that have been a great loss to patient representation, simply and solely because they got fed up of something new coming along that was going to be better, and it's never been better. The Community Health Council did a very, very good job. I think things have gone downhill rapidly since then.
Well, why can't we go back to that old system then, if it worked well?
Well, this probably comes as a great surprise to you, but they don't always listen to what I say.
Okay. Now, one of the more serious points that we've had in this last Conservative government has been the resignation of our local MP, Liam Fox. He was the Defence Secretary in a very powerful and important position, and the MP for North Somerset. And under his watch, we had this ridiculous, very strange deal signed with the British Harrier fleet, where 400 and something million pounds were spent on these Harriers to refurbish them, and then they were, once the refurbishment had finished, they were then sold off to the United States basically for scrap for 116 million pounds. Now, how on earth can that decision by Liam Fox be justified?
Well, I haven't discussed it with Liam Fox, but I have to say that I do find it a little bit strange. But what I will say is that unfortunately, politicians are always in the firing line when things don't go as they should do. And it's not always down to the politician themselves. It's very, very difficult to keep an eye on everything that happens, for instance, in the Defence Department.
Now, do you think there's a bit of a problem here? Because a lot of the time, anyone is in the MOD and in Defence, they're saying, well, you're not allowed to know anything about this because of national security. Whereas it seems that if we had known about this deal that Liam was doing with the Americans, then he would never have been allowed to do it in the first place. And actually, you know, getting rid of our Harrier fleet, surely that's a threat to national security.
Well, I don't know the full details, so it's quite difficult for me. But what I would say is that knowing Liam Fox, and I do know Liam Fox, and I was one of his constituents when he was first elected to Parliament, I have to say that he's not a stupid man, and he's not going to do something knowingly that's going to get him such a bad name. I know we can all make mistakes, and I do make mistakes, and all I can say is that he may have made a mistake, but I don't really know the details, so it's unfair of me to try and comment on something that I've got such little knowledge about.
But I wonder whether, if this had happened under a Labour administration, whether we'd have had almost a military coup, you know, saying this is absolutely outrageous, terrible, disgusting. And of course, the Labour Party have complained about it. But ultimately, it's not good for your party, is it?
Well, I think you're quite right. Whichever party is in opposition would seize the opportunity to jump up and down and shout and run. And if the Conservatives had been in opposition, I'm sure they'd have done the same thing.
Now I'm joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers too. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Now, will Chancellor Merkel get what she wanted all along, political union? Because they're absolutely out in the open this week. They're now saying that in order to get away from disaster, people like the Spanish and the Greeks, really what they need to do is vote for and go for political union in Europe.
Well, I understand there's four top Eurocrats, including Manuel Barroso and a few others, Mario Draghi, who are going round to all of the capitals in Europe over the next, you know, few weeks before this summit comes up at the end of the month, arguing exactly that kind of line. And even David Cameron has said that political union is necessary in order to underpin the single currency. We just don't want to be part of it, which seems to be rather extraordinary.
Saying you can have political union, but we don't want it.
The Conservative Party as a whole is opposed to political union, and Britain will have no part of it. You better get on with it, because otherwise the euro is going to collapse, and then that will collapse the British economy, and then that'll be my job on the line. It's an odd situation. I think Merkel is bringing this forward partly as a way to fend off the demands that she allows the European Central Bank to issue euro bonds, which is basically what the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve have been doing for ages. And a lot of people are saying, well, why can't the European Central Bank just print some money, basically? Now, the Germans originally designed the European Central Bank so that it couldn't print money. It's in its constitution. And so Merkel is, in fact, right, standing by the letter of the constitution, saying, well, they can't do that. And she's saying, all right, well, if we're going to do that, then we're going to have a whole new treaty. Yeah, we'll have to change the German constitution. We'll have to change the constitution of the ECB, and in that case, we're going to have a federal super state. And let's get clear about that. And I think what she's doing there is raising the stakes in order to frighten off the people who are trying to bully her into making the ECB do stuff right now. And of course, in actual fact, this European super state is a long way in the future, and the crisis is like tomorrow. So it's not really, you know, this is all a bit pie in the sky, frankly.
So do you think it's going to persuade the Greeks one way or another in the election? It's next week, I think, isn't it?
It's not just the Greeks now, it's the Spanish, because they're much bigger.
I know, yes, we've had the Spanish crisis, but what about, we've got an election coming up in Greece now.
Well, we saw what happened in the Irish.
Another election.
We saw what happened in the Irish referendum, where basically the establishment in Ireland and the existing government said, look, if you vote down this deal that we're doing with the EU to carry on bailing us out, as long as we carry on with this austerity policy, then we'll be in real trouble and we'll be on our own and nobody will support us and it's really scary. And there was a big bombardment, and basically people are scared. And if that's any indication of where the Greek electorate is, they may be scared to take the plunge. And so you may get another indecisive result, as we saw after the last election.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very, very difficult situation. My own views on it are that we're right not to be in the euro area. I think it would have been suicide if we were. I hear what I'm told as far as trade is concerned and the amount of trade that we do with Europe, etc. But we do a lot of trade with other people. I think it's a case of biting the bullet, quite honestly, and the sooner we do it, the better. And Greece, I don't know. The Greeks may vote to go down the road of austerity because of fear. But you look at the German side of it, I think that they're still suffering from what happened in the 1930s. They're still afraid of it all going really pear-shaped, a situation where I know that they used to pay people twice a day because the value of the mark had dropped so much during the morning that they had to pay them so much more at lunchtime.
Martin, is that a real fear in Germany, hyperinflation?
I think Chris is quite right. There's a big, strong historical fear. So it's not just Angela Merkel being awkward. She's representing the deepest fears of the German people about inflation. And of course, in the 30s and the 20s, the Germans were in the position that Greece is in now, where bigger powers were bullying them and saying, you owe us this money, get on with it. And of course, they printed money to try and get out of the problem, which is what the Greeks will do. Say they went back to the drachma, that's what they would be doing. And I think the scary thing is, I saw earlier on the internet that this far-right Golden Dawn MP from Greece, he was on a TV programme, Good Morning Greece, and he threw water in the face of this one left-wing MP woman, and then he tried to punch another one and then stormed off, and the police are now after him. And I think this is the danger. Don't forget, in Greece, people are saying, hang on a minute, Germany invaded us during the war, killed thousands of our people, wrecked our economy. Did you pay us a penny for that? No. We had a military dictatorship imposed from 1967 until 1972 by the British and the Americans. Did you pay us any money for that? No. Now we supposedly owe you all this money, and if we don't pay, X, Y, and Z's going to happen to us. Well, you know what you can do with that. And that's why they can't get a consensus around austerity, because even the right wing in Greece won't accept austerity from Germany, because of all this history. And this is the danger, is as the economy goes down, instead of talking about economics, we're going to start talking about all this other stuff, which is all the bodies buried under the patio. And that's really dangerous. Don't forget, Greece is right next to Serbia, right next to Yugoslavia. The same part of the world.
Martin, isn't the problem here that when these currencies went into the euro, these countries, sorry, when they gave up the drachma, when they gave up the peseta and the lira, they didn't realise that they were actually giving up a massive amount of power and control over their own currency. For example, they now have no ability to print their own money. The governments can't spend into their own economy.
There's not even a mechanism for taking people out of the euro. So when there is people,
it's like the Hotel California,
Merkel is saying, if you don't vote to do this austerity, we're going to throw you out of the euro. She said, well, there's nothing in the rule book for throwing people out of the euro. They'd have to write a whole new rule book. And what the left wing party Syriza are saying is, we don't want to leave the euro. We want to stay in the euro. We want you to bail us out, but we want you to be less stop bullying us to do austerity. We're willing to pay you back, but it's got to be on a more extended period. You've got to allow our economy to grow, and if you allow our economy to grow, then we can negotiate about paying.
But people
back.
Like John Redwood, for example, Martin, have said actually it's a fairly simple thing to do to give up a European currency like that and go back to your own system.
Well, do you know what? Before the existence of the derivatives market, it would have been an easy thing to do. You'd have had various options. But the problem is now, if Greece goes out of the euro and defaults on its debts, and lots of countries have defaulted on their debts in the past. Argentina did it in 2000. Every country in Latin America did it in the 30s.
So
it's what happens. But of course, if a country, even a tiny country like Greece, which only represents 2% of European GDP, if they default on their debts, the derivatives market bomb goes off.
So
the city of London,
this is a sort
and all
of
the banks go down, crash.
So is it a little bit like the loan shark knocking on the door and saying, well, it's time you paid up, and by the way, if you don't, the whole town is going to go up in flames.
Well, that's why the Greeks are playing chicken with Angela Merkel. They're saying, because the German banks had their credit rating marked down yesterday morning. Because, of course, if the Greeks go out, the German banks take the hit. And that's the problem. The British banks, Britain, as you know, it was one of the ratings agencies, I've forgotten the name of it, it's EGEN something or other. It's not one of the famous ones, but they have downgraded British debt from AA to AA minus. And of course, again, it's to do with the fact that the economic policy of the government doesn't look as if it's working, because we will get in the same trap as Ireland and as Greece, where the economy will be going down and the debt to GDP ratio will be going up, and at that point you're in a cul-de-sac. And we're all going into that cul-de-sac, not just Britain, everybody.
We've also heard this week that the Spanish government, the Spanish finance minister, doesn't want the European bailout. He wants to sort out their debts in a completely different way and domestically organise it.
He wants direct payments to their banks rather than going through what the rules say at the moment.
Can you just explain that then? What's he asking for?
The rules say at the moment is that if the Spanish want a bailout, they have to go to the European Union. The European Union gives them the money to the Spanish government, and then the Spanish government bails out their banks. So it all goes on the public accounts of Spain. What the Spanish are asking for is, why don't you just directly bail our banks out and leave us out of it? Yeah, because if the banks go down in Spain, it's going to pull your banks down. It's in your interest to do this. But that's not possible under existing EU rules. So what you've got is people like Francois Hollande from France are pushing, well, never mind the rules, this is an emergency, we've got to change the rules.
Yeah, well, we know it's all a big house of cards. What the Spanish are quite cleverly doing then is they're trying to pull out the public and the government from that house of cards and say, well, if the banks are all going to go down, we want out.
Well, what's happening is everybody is wriggling around. I mean, it's a conservative government in Spain, and they're not in a position to... They're basically saying, we're not, you know, we don't want any more austerity, it ain't going to work. And I think we will reach that point sometime soon as well. People will realise austerity... I mean, it's not having austerity doesn't solve your problem. You're still in a mess.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, can you just answer that one? Because we're hearing from the present coalition that austerity, we're just going to have to keep plugging away with austerity. We've heard this week in a special report from the BBC Points West yesterday that the Bristol courts can't actually pay their judges, that court cases are being delayed. I'm sure there are some criminals who are quite happy about that, but are you?
Well, I've not got any case coming up at the moment, so it doesn't benefit me directly. But I think it's a bad situation. And I don't know the answer to this. I don't like to see these savage cuts affecting families, etc., etc. On the other hand, I'm frightened, and I mean this particularly for my grandchildren, I'm frightened that if we don't do something... pretty drastic at this moment in time, we're going to be Greece in a few years.
And what do you mean by that? You mean really we're going to have almost all our public services taken apart because of the banksters?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I mean, that's not fair, though, is it? I mean, these bankers are going off with their bonuses, and what we're seeing then is the most vulnerable people in society being hammered for it.
But if you haven't got the money, then you can't buy the services or the goods. And if you can't borrow the money, well, where are you then?
Well, isn't it fair to say that, you know, something needs to be done in the Treasury to actually start taking out? I mean, for example, we've had all this quantitative easing that's been going on, billions and billions of that, printing money, but that's all going to the banks and it's stopping there. It's not finding its way to the government or to the economy, is it?
No. You want to ask me about the banks? Well, all I can say about the banks is, having run my own business for 31 years and having had to rely upon the banks, on those occasions when I wanted their support most was the time that they were quite happy to pull the plug. I don't have a great deal of confidence in the banks, and I never have.
So it wasn't you that put the bricks through the window down in Knowle at the NatWest Bank then last week, Chris?
No, somebody got there before me.
Okay. Anyway, over to Marina Morris now, who has a report on this week's sensational and some would say scandalous report from Bristol University.
Hello. The effects of exercise on depression. A recent study published in the British Medical Journal, funded by the Health Service and conducted in part by the University of Bristol, has cast doubts on current clinical guidance which recommends exercise for patients suffering from depression. The study followed the outcomes of 361 patients diagnosed with clinical depression during a 12-month period, who were divided into two groups. All patients received normal treatment, and one group, in addition, undertook a regime of physical activity. This study found that the exercise regime had no significant effects on clinical outcome. In contrast, numerous other studies have reported positive effects. When we exercise, the body produces natural chemicals, mainly endorphins, but also serotonin and dopamine, which are all believed to contribute to natural good feelings by changing our brain chemistry. Perhaps the study shows that if we are already taking a cocktail of similar drugs from our doctors, a little more naturally produced drugs will have little or no extra beneficial effect. Many of us would benefit from increased physical activity, especially people with medical conditions such as obesity, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. Sensible levels of exercise can also improve many of our lives, regardless of how we interpret these results. Mental illness affects 1 in 6 UK adults at any time, and 1 in 4 people will experience mental illness during their lifetime. It is the largest single cause of disability in our society and costs the English economy £77 billion a year. 1 million British children, or 1 in 10 between the age of 5 to 16, are estimated to be mentally ill. Different studies show that negative emotion increases the risks of heart attack and heart disease, diabetes, and delay recovery from hip fractures. It is not only 1 in 4 adults and 1 in 10 children who experience mental problems. It is all of us living this toxic depressive tendency or the radiated backlash of the unwell. Emotions are still a foreign country for lots of us, and we underestimate the vital role of our emotional state in determining quality of life and satisfaction. It is time to start to value a positive emotional state, fundamental aspects of human well-being. And according to the mental health charity Mind, good mental health isn't something you have, but something you do.
Thanks very much, Marina. Well, Chris Windows, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, your thoughts on this then? Because I think, you know, certainly my experience chatting to people about things that are actually quite useful in depression, exercise is one of the most important things which can help people with depression. So I do wonder what Bristol University think they're talking about, saying that it doesn't actually help.
Well, I saw this report in brief, really. and I found it was very depressing. Which I don't think would have been the intention of the people that published the report, Bristol University. I find it very difficult to accept their views. I know that when you take exercise, good, strong exercise, you do feel good. And if you feel good, you're less likely to feel depressed. So it seems to be a bit of a no-brainer to say that it doesn't have any difference. It doesn't make any difference at all. I think they've taken a very simplistic view of it. I don't think they've taken into account the drugs that people may be taking, the severity of the mental problems that they've got. There seems to be a skating over the surface. I'm not sure that I believe the report.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this whole sort of idea? I mean, depression is something we hear about more and more nowadays. Do you think it's linked to the sort of wider social conditions and changes in society?
It obviously is. I find it hard to believe the findings of this report because it's obvious. I mean, it's intuitive that exercise does
help.
I'm depressed, I go for a long walk in the country. It often works, you know.
And it's actually a chemical thing, isn't it? We heard about the endorphins, the serotonin, the dopamine there. It's a chemical thing. It actually does make you physically better having these chemicals going through your body.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've seen in the crisis, for example, is that in Greece, I believe, the suicide rate jumped by 40% last year. And I think this is the real consequences of all of this, is that real people are really going to the edge and over the edge.
What would you say to people who feel a little bit helpless and hopeless, seeing that the you know, basic things they need, particularly, you know, people who are more vulnerable in society being taken away from them?
I remember reading George Orwell talking about how people got through the 1930s. I think it was in The Road to Wigan Pier, because it's a series of essays, and he said, well, how did people cope? And he said, well, people coped by, you know, little treats, like sending out to the chip shop for some chips, you know, once a week. And also, he said, when people weren't working, he said, of an afternoon, you'd see people getting in groups and going off walking in the, you know, because what you've got when you're unemployed is time, and you've got to realize that is your life, and you must use that time well, even if you haven't got a job. And you've got to, you know, you've got to find some value in your life, even if everybody else thinks you're a loser.
Okay, on to another big story this week, and that is claims of the Jubilee Labour camps are misinformed, says the boss of CPUK. And this is a quote from a mother of one of the government's Jubilee stewards, who writes, "My child was part of this farce up in London at the Jubilee, but he is so desperate for a job he's stuck it out. He's been on the phone in tears saying they're soaking wet, bleeding feet and sleeping in a wet muddy field with barely any facilities. And I've said, for God's sake, come home, but if they did it would be the end of the course and no SIA badge. I feel murderous. They are still there with one more night to do. Let's not forget that we as parents also had to provide a tent and all the camping gear. Not cheap." Well, Chris, this is a little bit embarrassing, isn't it, that basically there was slave labour being used, unpaid people up there acting as stewards, and also being kept in the worst conditions under the threat of, if they didn't, they'd lose their benefits.
Well, I have to say, it certainly looks that way. I feel that there are always unscrupulous people about. They're not always easily identifiable. And there are a lot of people that feel quite desperate, particularly the youngsters at the moment, with the job market as it is, who are so keen to do anything to improve their chances, that they are vulnerable to people who would take advantage of them. Now, I'm not saying that the actual organisers set out to take advantage of their vulnerability, because I don't know. But all I can say is that certainly on the surface, it looks as though they need to be investigated, and there need to be strong rules brought in to protect these vulnerable youngsters.
The story of the 80 unemployed men and women who were signed on to the government's work programme for the unemployed, then bussed from Plymouth and Bristol to steward the Queen's Jubilee celebrations, has spread wide since campaigners blew the whistle. And I was seeing it in newspapers in Canada and Australia. The trainees, so-called, many working without wages, were told to sleep under a London bridge before their shift and billeted in a boggy campsite afterwards. In between, they had to change into uniforms in public and got inadequate food and toilet facilities. So who was behind this cheap, nasty exploitation, says Solomon Hughes on Thursday in the Morning Star. A fly-by-night security firm, an incompetent charity, perhaps. But ultimate responsibility lies with a massive company called Prospects Services. Its £76 million turnover comes from almost entirely from government contracts. Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith didn't want to deal with small firms or charities for his work programme, so the huge government contracts go to a small group of big firms called the Primes. Prospects has the £50 million Prime Work Programme contract for the South West. They then subcontracted some of their trainees to the charity Tomorrow's People. In turn, it got a small Lancashire security company with a weak financial history, Close Protection UK, to drag the trainees up to the Jubilee. Well, Martin, this is, it's almost like three levels of arm's length, isn't it? So the government is contracting to this stuff out to the work programme up to Prospect Services. They're then contracting it out again. And then again, you know, so it's almost like the responsibility...
It's like the lump in the building industry, isn't it? Well, yes, I mean, what strikes me about this, I mean, Emma, whatever her name is, who runs A4E...
Emma Harrison.
Who used to run A4E. But, I mean, basically, what you've got is private companies who are basically... I mean, she's a millionaire on the back of government contracts. Now, to my mind, she is what we used to call a government employee. She is, in fact, a civil servant. She doesn't. The only customer she's got is the government. And what we're trying to do in the civil service is cut down the wages paid to the top level civil servants. But meanwhile, because it's called the private sector, although that's an illusion, she's allowed to basically make herself a millionaire on the back of the taxpayer. Now that's the problem. If these young people, should have been better treated. That's obvious. You know, they should have had basic facilities for them and so on. But as Chris was saying, they're going along because they're keen and they want to show that they're keen, and that should be encouraged. But the people who are placing them and organising it shouldn't be making a profit out of it. That's
so
the
who
point.
Is responsible for
this? They shouldn't be making
this.
A profit Look, out of people who are working for nothing.
Who is actually responsible for this absolutely horrendous thing, for these 80 unemployed men and women? Is it Prospect Services? Is it Ian Duncan Smith, the Department for Work and Pensions? Well, is it Tomorrow's People?
Or is it
Close Protection UK?
Well, I think ultimately the buck stops with the government. It's their policy to subcontract this kind of work to private enterprise. Although it isn't private enterprise, it's basically government expenditure. This is a big delusion. A lot of private companies, in fact, have one customer, the government, and those companies are, in fact, part of the government, but at arm's length. But if they're going to, if you're going to have schemes for helping the unemployed, they've had schemes like this for years in places like Sweden, but they are run by the government, not for profit, and there are strict rules about how they're run. And that's how you do it. That's how they do it in Scandinavia. They don't subcontract it to a list of cowboys.
Chris Windows, isn't this part of the problem, that we've got this complete sort of grey area as who's actually responsible, whether it's, you know, your Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith, whether it's Prospect Services, whether it's Tomorrow's People or Close Protection UK? Isn't it quite convenient for these businesses that and for the government department, that actually it's a little bit unclear as to who's really responsible?
You're suggesting smoke and mirrors, are you? Well, I know smoke and mirrors exist for various reasons. All I can say is, as far as Ian Duncan Smith is concerned, I've talked to him in the past. I come to realise that if he has a failing, it's that he cares too much. He does really care about things that a lot of people would push under the carpet. He's a caring person, and if this has gone wrong, as it appears to have done, then I'm quite sure that he will be sorting it out as quickly as possible. I don't know how much power he has in this, but I'm sure whatever power he has and whatever he can grab hold of, he will use to sort this out, because I know for a fact that personally he must be horrified as to what happened.
But can't the Queen afford to pay these people properly? I mean, you know, the Queen has got all the land, she's got a massive income, she's got, you know, a fantastic, fantastic wealth, one of the wealthiest people in the world. Surely she can afford to pay these people to steward her little event.
Well, you're talking to a dyed-in-the-wool monarchist here, I'm afraid. I think that we do very, very well out of our relationship with the Queen.
But it doesn't doesn't speak very well for her, with all her wealth, that she's using this actual... I mean, it's not exactly slave labour, but it's free labour, and people who are being conned, really, into working in dreadful conditions for no pay.
Let's look at this sensibly and say that the Jubilee celebrations really and truly were not for the Queen. They were there for the country. And those people that organised it in a way which they felt the country would appreciate most. I mean, I'm quite sure that on Sunday with the river procession, the Queen would much rather have been sat with the Duke in a nice warm palace watching it all on television. So it wasn't arranged for her. So I think it's a little bit unfair to expect her to pay towards it. Most of the money that went towards that came from private donations from people. So, you know, I think it's a red herring. I think it's the job of the government to sort these things out, and I think that's what they should do. And I don't think we should try and use the Queen as a whipping girl. I'm glad she's where she is. She does a lot of good for the country. She brings in an awful lot of foreign money. And where would we be if we had certain politicians that were elevated to the position of monarch, even if they weren't called it? I dread to think.
Okay, Marty, I'm going to give you the final word on this. Why can't the Queen just pay these people properly?
Well, I think Chris is right. It's not the Queen's responsibility. I mean, as he says, the Queen is basically, certainly on this occasion, is doing it for us. I mean, she's the one, as you say, who's standing out in the rain. Also, I mean, I think she did a very good job when she went to Ireland a couple of years ago. It was a very professional job because it was a very, very sensitive task, and she did it with great skill, you know, total professional. And everybody in Ireland was really, really happy about it because that was the first visit by a British monarch ever, really. And so it was a very important symbolic occasion, and she did everything exactly right. But I mean, the fact is that we're getting into a situation now where young people are vulnerable to exploitation, and it's getting worse. And that, you know, my heart goes out to the younger generation in this country today and all across Europe, because they're staring into a very, very bleak future.
But what hope is there for these young people?
Well, ultimately, they've got to get involved in politics and change things for the better. They shouldn't be encouraged to the idea that politics isn't for them, and that they shouldn't get involved in it. They should get involved in it. That's what they need to do for their own futures.
OK, before we totally leave the Jubilee celebrations, David Cameron wasn't in Prime Minister's Question Time this week, but instead, he was in St Paul's Cathedral. Let's see what he had to say.
I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. For by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. For as in one body we have many members, and not all the members have the same function, so we, who are many, are one body in Christ, and individually we are members one of another. We have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us: prophecy in proportion to faith, ministry in ministering, the teacher in teaching, the exhorter in exhortation, the giver in generosity, the leader in diligence, the compassionate in cheerfulness. Let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not lag in zeal. Be ardent in spirit, serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope, be patient in suffering, persevere in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints, extend hospitality to strangers. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Well, David Cameron, as you don't usually hear him, that was at St Paul's Cathedral on Tuesday. Chris Windows, your local Henbury Conservative councillor. What are your thoughts there? He's talking about associating with the lowly, being peaceable to all, and also this whole thing of extending hospitality to strangers. Do you think, is this just David Cameron reading out something he doesn't believe in, or do you think there's some reality, some political reality to what he's saying in St Paul's Cathedral? I suppose what I'm really asking about is, you know, is there any kind of real interface between our politics and religion?
Well, thanks for this. really appreciate it. This is where I probably dig a huge hole for myself and fall headlong into it by saying that I wasn't quite sure, first of all, whether or not it was the Archbishop of Canterbury sounding like the Prime Minister, or the Prime Minister sounding like the Archbishop of Canterbury. I'm glad it was said in St Paul's Cathedral and not in the House. He's obviously expressing his own personal views, and good luck to him.
Well, what about extending hospitality to strangers? What does that say about immigration policy?
Well, I think we've been doing that for many, many, many years, haven't we?
Martin, what about you?
Well, hang on. Is he not reading the lesson? He's reading the lesson, isn't he? So those aren't David Cameron's words. Those are the words of either St Paul or Jesus. I can't remember which. And, you know, they're all admirable sentiments. But the question is, I mean, you know, we are challenged by... I mean, I think it's very important that people are challenged by those sentiments, as you were picking up on certain things that might be contradictory with some of the, you know, political positions he's taken. But on the other hand, I think we shouldn't be getting to be... religion has its place in society, but it's not... We're a country that tends to be sceptical of those who are over-religious, because it's usually a cover for some kind of hypocrisy. Yeah, I mean, we've all read our Charles Dickens and so on, and the most religious people are often the least caring, and therefore we don't have what they have in the US, where everybody's got to profess how Christian they are and all the rest of it. People in this country are rightly a bit sceptical about that sort of thing, and I don't think it's a bad thing that they are.
Okay, now, Police Chief Inspector's choice is a declaration of war. And this is from this morning's Today programme on BBC Radio 4. The Home Office and the Police Federation are at loggerheads over the choice of former rail regulator Tom Windsor as the preferred Chief Inspector of Constabulary for England and Wales. Dr. Tim Brain, former Chief Constable of Gloucester, says the choice is exactly in line with government policy on police leadership. He says it's very symbolic and a hugely provocative decision. So let's have a listen to Tim now, as well as criminologist and filmmaker who speaks after him, Roger Graff.
I think this is exactly in line with the government philosophy on police leadership. They're very critical of police leadership. They really show a lot of contempt for it. They want to see fewer police professionals at the top and more people from outside. So this is exactly in line with government thinking. It's very symbolic. It's hugely provocative.
Even a government that has made so many PR mistakes couldn't have made this is a mistake, this is a decision. But I think it's effectively a declaration of war. And I think that's a mistake, because actually the police culture that I've experienced includes a very great range of people, but they all share a mistrust of outsiders in the sense that, and I think they're right to, very few people understand just how much is expected of the police and how little of that they can actually deliver unless everybody is on side. It's called policing by consent, and you can only do that, first of all, obviously, with the consent of the police itself and then of the community they're policing.
So that was Roger Graff there, rather than Graff, as you called him. I mean, I think he's famous for making one of the first fly-on-the-wall documentaries where he followed around police on their daily you know, on their daily round, and they were, you know, fly on the wall documentaries are 10 a penny now, but when he did them back in the 70s they were a new thing. And of course he had to hang around for quite a long time because the cameras were quite big in those days, so that the police eventually get just used to having the camera there and then just behave normally. Nowadays of course we've all got these kind of tiny little cameras and it's not that obvious that you're being filmed, but in those days it was.
But the point here is, what he's saying there is in a hugely provocative decision. That's the former chief constable of Gloucester saying that, and this Roger Graeff saying that it's a declaration of war.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not really keen on this idea of electing police commissioners. Nor am I. And as you know, as a totally lay person, I'm not really sure I want the guy who used to be the regulator of the railways running the police force. I mean,
but this isn't the commissioners, Martin. This isn't the commissioners.
No,
this
I know. The same idea is bringing people in from outside, and I can understand the police's frustration with that, because police work is in fact extremely specialised, very, very, they don't always get it right, when goodness knows they often get it wrong and they need to be held to account. But really the idea that some clever amateur can come in and teach them a few tricks is frankly fatuous.
Well, I'm afraid I have to agree with you there. I think, yes, you should have specialists for specialist occupations or businesses or whatever else. I'm not sure this guy is the right choice.
Well, he's a former rail regulator, and one wonders whether that's actually been a roaring success, the regulation of our railways.
Well, I have travelled on the train over the last few years. I haven't always enjoyed it. In fact, I can't actually remember enjoying any of it. And I take your point that...
And it's the same chap, really, that's delivered this report, which we had thousands of off-duty police officers from right around the country, actually 2 weeks ago or so, marching in London against the report that he's already delivered. So, I mean, they're already making it clear that they're very hostile, that the Police Federation are very hostile to this chap, and the changes he's trying to implement.
Well, the politics of that are quite interesting, because if you think back to the 1980s and the Thatcher government, they gave a lot of money to the police. They gave them a big pay increase. They improved their terms and conditions, and I remember how it was at the time. There was a very strong perception, especially in poor communities, that the police were supportive of the government, and that there was a very kind of, you know, negative attitude flowed from that. But I think what we've got today, and I find it's very odd for a Conservative government to be doing this, they're going out of their way to antagonise the police of all ranks. And they chose to demonstrate, those off-duty police officers, the other day, 30,000 of them or something like that, or 10,000, I can't remember. But they chose the same day as the public sector strikes that everybody else was engaged in, and which was a signal by them that they are actually not very happy with the government and its policy. So that's a rather big, big difference from the 1980s, and possibly a crucial one. If the government loses the support of the police service.
Well, let's see how it all goes, and if he gets appointed. On to our next story, and a fraud squad fails to raid a single suspect. This was a very fascinating story, but only reported in the Sunday Express last weekend. The Serious Fraud Office had to apologise to Robert Tekunitz and his brother for mishandling information in a case. Fraud investigators have failed to carry out a single raid in the past financial year, figures show. The Serious Fraud Office did not search any properties between April the 1st last year and March the 31st this year, according to records obtained by a law firm. Government agency conducted 47 raids in 2010 to 11, 43 in 2009 to 10, and 63 in 2008 to 9. Financial crime has risen because of the tough economic climate. The cost of fraud to the economy is £73 billion, according to government statistics, yet the budget of the Serious Fraud Office has been reduced from £51.5 million in 2008 to £32 million this year. Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously we're just hearing about this. I mean, I think we nearly need to boost up the Serious Fraud Office. We know that there are criminals operating in the financial markets, for example, and it's very difficult to catch these people because they're clever people, and therefore a lot of effort has to go into it. I mean, the case that they were talking about, the something brothers, whatever they're called, the Chengiz brothers, I mean... these kind of people are not stupid people, and they cover their tracks very well. But at the same time, there should be, I mean, the serious fraud office is very important. Justice needs to be seen to be done, especially if we're going to have a cuts policy and people are going to lose their livelihoods and so on. People at the top have got to be seen to be towing the line as well, and the serious fraud office is the cutting edge of that. And the fact that they've not arrested anybody or they've not raided anybody in a year is not very encouraging, is it?
Chris Windows, what are your thoughts? So the final sentence of this story, the new director, David Green, of the Serious Fraud Office, is apparently keen to restore confidence in the agency and clarify its remit to focus on the most complex frauds, leaving the Financial Services Authority and the City of London Police to handle less serious cases. It sounds to me as if maybe there's a little bit of a grey area as to which of these agencies, that maybe the smoke and mirrors again, which of these three agencies is supposed to be doing the raids. But pretty shocking to hear that there's been no raids whatsoever by the fraud squad in an age where we're being told that there's massive banking fraud going on.
Well, it would seem to me that one of the problems, and they mentioned the fact that they have drawn back because of the legal implications that came in, that we are in a terrible situation in this country where the law that is supposed to protect us all very often works against us. Particularly, it works against good things and seems to support bad things. And I know that a lot of people out there in the legal profession will jump up and down at hearing me say that, but I have to say, you know, the law itself tends to act against these things. It's all very well to have an agency. You've got to protect that agency if you want it to work properly.
Martin, another fascinating story this week, I think, hasn't got anywhere near as much coverage as it should have. The UK banks are sitting on £40 billion worth of undeclared losses. This was in the Telegraph. Britain's banks are sitting on a £40 billion black hole of undeclared losses that are preventing them from making the vital loans to businesses and households. Royal Bank of Scotland was in the worst condition with £18 billion of undeclared losses. Now, surely this is fraud, isn't it?
Well, fraud is at the root of all of this, because a lot of these derivative contracts are in fact fraudulent contracts.
I mean, if you've got a loss, you've got to declare it on your balance sheet, surely.
Yeah, you'd have thought so. And if you were running any other kind of business, you would be definitely in breach of
company
law.
It does seem to sort of, in a way, a pat on the back for you for what you've been saying about the banks actually being bust, but simply being in denial about that.
Well, they've been bust all along. If you went through the books properly and marked to market what they've got on the books rather than marked to magic, they're allowed to. That these derivative contracts have been put in their books as full value, and most of them are worth a fraction of that value, if that. And of course, eventually, this is the big elephant in the room, which is causing all of the problems. I mean, Paul Craig Roberts, who used to be Reagan's financial advisor, or, you know, he used to run the Office of Management and Budget, I think, he basically said we should just cancel the whole derivatives market, just cancel all those contracts.
Chris, why are UK banks not declaring these £40 billion worth of losses? Because what they're doing is they're basically, I mean, what are being called more and more nowadays, zombie banks. They're wandering around even though they're financially dead.
Well, I've already said that I'm a dyed-in-the-wool monarchist. I don't feel the same way about the banks.
Okay, finally then, Holland lowers the French retirement age. France's new socialist government took on Europe's bosses and bankers on Wednesday to lower the retirement age from 62 to 60 years old.
Well, I think this is interesting, isn't it? Because we were talking about health earlier and so on. The French are saying we should use the crisis as an opportunity to build the kind of society we want, with less work, not more.
Chris, final words. Good idea.
Doomed to disaster.
Why is that?
Well, because there just isn't enough money to be able to do it properly.
Okay, well, that's all for this hour. Thank you very much to Chris Windows, who's the Conservative councillor for Henbury. After the news, Britain's gone further down the surveillance road than any other state in the world. No money for schools, but plenty for the snooping technology.
Unity Station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.